This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. We're glad you joined us once again for another episode of Taking Aim. I'm Steve Woodward. Joining me, as always, is David Hensley. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everyone.
Feeling kind of chipper today, I think, which is nice, even though we're supposed to be in complete panic mode over the issuance of tariffs against our trade partners who have been ripping us off for decades. We're supposed to be panic and calling our stockbrokers, but I'm not engaging in any of that. I'm just waiting for the long-term effect of this, which is going to be quite important to restoring American manufacturing and bringing a lot more jobs back home to our shores and marginalizing China in particular, and to a lesser degree some other Asian countries and Canada from ripping us off on imbalanced tariffs. There, I said it.
Yes, you did.
And I covered it. And that's probably, we'll talk a little bit about that more broadly later in the show. But let's get right to it as we hone in on our targets for this Taking Aim edition. We're going to start with Public Enemy number one. And boy, it was such an easy pick this week. It was just a slam dunk. It has to be, it will be, the unhinged New Jersey Senator Democrat Cory Booker.
Cory, I am Spartacus Booker.
Yes, I am Spartacus, but that goes back to, was that the Kavanaugh hearing, confirmation?
Yeah, but we had a local Spartacus, Rolly Sampson. Remember Rolly Sampson, school board candidate? She showed up one time and gave an, I am Spartacus, and we will fight
yeah,
for
I kinda
LGBTQ
remember.
Rights.
She believed that that if we did not, her part of her campaign for school board was that failure to recognize the pronouns of transgender students could cause them to commit suicide. It didn't work, and she never got elected.
A fellow Spartacus, her and Cory Booker are Spartacus.
So Senator Booker from New Jersey, who you know, is one of these younger Democrats who they often talk about as having presidential aspirations. Of course, you know, that's like all. Pretty much anybody in the Senate these days, on both sides of the aisle, actually. Booker decided that he needed to spend a good deal of time calling out all of the atrocities of the first 70-plus days of the Trump 47 administration, because, you know, so many bad things have been happening, like the border's now closed, fentanyl is not flowing over the border as much as it was by a long shot. Food prices are going down. But all of those things are off his radar. He's more concerned about all the other atrocities. So he took to the floor of the Senate, and he did so for a couple of reasons. Number one, he wanted to, you know, draw attention to his unhinged ranting. Number two, there has been a record held since 1957 by former and late Senator Strom Thurmond for the longest floor speech in Senate history, which was somewhere north of 20 hours. This was 57. Thurmond was a virulent segregationist, and he stood to speak against the civil rights that was brewing, the civil rights legislation that was brewing at that time in the late 50s. Booker wanted to break that record just because, and then also, as it turns out, in this age of social media dominance, he apparently was running up numbers on TikTok and other social media platforms during this, what ended up being a 25-hour marathon of him talking, literally, straight, 25 hours. I don't believe he used the facilities once during that time. He says that he fasted for a full day ahead of the marathon.
Well, he is Spartacus.
And so I don't know how that, you know, in terms of his health, I don't know what the ramifications of that will be. But in reality, you know, you could, and I went through various, you know, sound bites to hear what he was talking about, and a lot of it was to be framing his constituents as entirely victims of something, victims of economic imbalance, victims of racism, victims of all kinds of things that, you know, apparently he as an elected official can't do anything about.
How inspirational. What a leader.
It was, yeah.
You all are all victims and I am your leader. I mean, how inspiring. You know who we have? You know who we have to thank for Spartacus Booker, right?
Yeah, wasn't he a guy who you didn't want to be behind in the buffet?
Right, Chris Christie. Right. If everyone, Cory Booker, we have Rhino Extraordinaire, Crony Establishment, Chris Christie, kind of the Tom Beddow of New Jersey, right? You almost spit up your water.
You know, you always have to go there.
You know, he was running for president, and for some reason, the sitting New Jersey senator died or something, the position became vacant, and Chris Christie could have just appointed
a Republican
as the interim senator who would serve out the rest of the term, you know, a couple years, and then run as an incumbent. But Chris Christie, you know, wanted to rise above it, and he could never be that partisan. So he elected as the governor of New Jersey, he elected not to exercise his right to appoint a Republican, a replacement, and he let it go to a special election. We have an establishment crony, Chris Christie, to thank for Cory Booker.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Once again, screwed by the Rhino crony establishment.
So I think the most unforgivable part of what Booker had to say, part of the most outrageous, absurd thing that he had to say in his 25 hours of ranting, was he conveniently managed to overlook 4 years of Bidenomics, which crushed a lot of middle and working class Americans, which caused energy prices to soar, which caused companies to take jobs away from American factories and take them overseas. All of those things were overlooked, but Booker wanted to pin every single issue that's out there affecting people's lives on the first 72 days of the Trump administration. Play clip one.
71 days in, now 72 days, I asked you, are you better off than you were 72 days ago economically? I asked that question. Ask it to your friends. Are they better off economically? Well, I don't see how they could be, because prices are up, stock market's down, the risk of recession is climbing, consumer confidence is in the gutter, 401k plans are losing value. Are you better off than you were 72 days ago under this president's leadership, on the verge of his so-called liberation day that's going to drive prices up even more? And he's doubling down on tax cuts for the rich. He wants an economy that works for him, his billionaire donors, his powerful special interests, and is coming at the expense of working people who are struggling to get by, and a lot of the programs that they rely on, like for their health care, like for their Social Security. He wants an economy where the richest people get the biggest tax cuts, where the largest corporations, heck, they may get to skip out on taxes altogether, and where hardworking Americans are getting crushed by rising food prices and rising rents.
And by the way, there are some economists who say we are already 15 months into an actual recession. So that means that, 13 of those months fall under the Biden regime, if I'm doing my math correctly. So I don't know where he is deriving his 72-day narrative. And another thing, you know, members of Congress are very attuned to the state of the stock market, because they all, you know, insider trade to inflate the size of their portfolios like nobody's business. Their constituents, these working class people who he says he has so much compassion for, most of them don't even have stock holdings or 401ks. They could care less about the stock market. So to use the stock market as a primary gauge of the state of the economy shows how out of touch the guy is, clearly.
Thank you, Chris Christie. That's all I got to say.
Whatever happened to him?
You know, I think he surfaces occasionally trying to be relevant, but, you know, he does his 15 seconds on MSNBC, and even they can't put up with him.
You know, he had a moment or two where he seemed like a legitimate conservative up-and-coming potential star, but obviously that was all smoke and mirrors.
Well, when he first ran for governor, you know, he was this badass U.S. attorney prosecutor, but then he immediately just proved himself to be yet another establishment rhino.
Yeah, and boy, do we have a lot of them.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's always a prime runner-up for public enemy number one every week, and sometimes there's more than one. This week we have a real piece of work. You may have heard of a television program called 60 Minutes. Sort of a thing, I guess. I haven't watched it in years, since the days of Mike Wallace and Morley Safer. Right.
I'm doing the TikTok.
You're doing it not a very... You need to practice. We should rehearse these things
yes.
before we bring them to the airwaves. But anyway... Leslie Stahl, who is an ancient fossil of a lefty, fake journalist, has been on CBS for I don't know decades. I think she has been around so long that she might have dated Huntley and Brinkley. I don't know, but anyway, the gentleman, one of many Americans who was held hostage by the Hamas bloodthirsty terrorists for many months. And has now been freed thanks to, Donald Trump.
Yes, the greatest of all time president.
His name is Keith Siegel. He actually has spent part of his formative years, his childhood, in living in Durham, North Carolina. Keith Siegel was one of the hostages that endured many months of torture and neglect at the hands of these monsters.
And he's an elderly guy, too.
He's in his 70s. He was one of the oldest hostages. Yeah. Yes, that's correct. Yeah. So he's home now, thankfully, and for whatever reason, I don't know why, he agreed to be interviewed by Leslie Stahl for a 60-minute segment.
Maybe he wanted to date her.
Yeah, well, I don't think he was that desperate. He's married, by the way, and thankfully his wife had been released early on after the October 7th, 2023
That's remarkable
event.
They were both hostages.
Yes, exactly.
Survived. That's a miracle.
But she was freed early on, and then he was kept until the very end. But you're going to have to listen to this line of questioning by Leslie Stahl to understand just how deranged she is and what her actual intent was for doing this interview. Play clip two.
The terrorists became very mean and very cruel and violent.
More so.
Much more so. They were beating me and starving me.
Do you think they starved you or they just didn't have food?
No, I think they starved me, and they would often eat in front of me and not offer me food.
Do you think they were starving you because they're terrorists, or do you think they just had run out of food themselves?
What a, you know, you cannot hate, demonstrating once again that we cannot hate the legacy media enough.
You're correct. And I was fortunate to come across a penetrating analysis of the derangement of Leslie Stahl's line of questioning, delivered by a Washington area radio commentator, a conservative talk radio, kind of a legend in the D.C. area, named Larry O'Connor. Play clip three.
You have to be an Upper West Side of Manhattan intellectual to even form the thought in your head, let alone then make the synapses inspire you to say something that vile out loud while sitting across from a freed hostage, a person who was tortured by terrorists. Sure, they didn't feed you, but of course, you know, the Israelis, they cut off the supply line, so they didn't have any food. So it's really Netanyahu's fault.
So
that's exactly what was going through her addled brain, and that's exactly why she subjected this guy, Mr.
Right.
Siegel, to the most absurd a question you could ask after his many days in, you know, being starved and God only knows what else.
Yeah, and look, if they were without food, right, it's much more likely that the DoorDash guy who was supposed to bring him the food just dropped the food and ran off and joined the jihad.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, that's much more likely than, you know, Trump having the Israeli target the food relief. Just these people are, like I said, you cannot hate the legacy media enough.
Well, what he's getting at there, and what she was insinuating, is that when Netanyahu, when he was accused of withholding humanitarian relief, that was somehow affecting these hostages. What they were really trying to do is withhold from the source of the problem, which was Hamas and its Iranian overlords.
The humanitarian relief that's been provided to Gaza for decades is what allowed Hamas to build their concrete tunnels and stockpile supplies. That food wasn't reaching the people. It was all being stolen by the government, and the government of Gaza is Hamas. The people elected Hamas. People overlook this. You know, it's like we firebombed Dresden. I mean, we destroyed Germany because the people elected Hitler. Hitler was a bad guy. If you elect bad guys, your cities get leveled, right? The Gaza, the Palestinians who lived in Gaza, elected Hamas, who invaded Israel. And Israel retaliates by attacking Gaza. That's kind of how that works. It's the way it worked in World War I, World War II, Korea. I mean, that's the way wars work. If you don't want to be bombed, don't elect bad guys.
But if you talk to the anti-Semites who thrive on our college campuses, who become college presidents and professors in some cases, they'll just... Without saying it, they always lead to the conclusion that Israel is the only sovereign nation in the world that shouldn't be allowed to defend itself, ever.
They put them nuts. Okay.
And that's just, you know, garbage. But let's move on. There's so much to get to. And boy, what a busy week it was of crazy. We mentioned at the top of the show the long-awaited Trump tariff plan, which, you know, is – you know, leaders, great leaders do hard things. And there's a reason why no president in our lifetimes have ever taken on the tariff imbalances, especially as they apply to our trade with China, or so-called trade with China. And really, the whole point of this is the long game. It's not tomorrow's stock market. It's not next week's avocado prices. It is, what are we doing this for in the long term, and what will the dividends and benefits be? I refer you to a really intelligent economist, somebody who I think has no rival in terms of being able to explain complex matters when it comes to economics. Play Jim Rickards, clip 4.
We have a test case for this, or a real world example. The first 2 years of the Reagan administration, 81, 82, we had the worst recession since the Great Depression at that time. We've had worse ones since, but that was a very bad depression. We came out of it from 1983 to 1986. The U.S. economy grew 16% real. That's not with inflation. There was inflation, some inflation, but 16% real growth. That's the kind of growth you can have with, you know, with tax cuts and with the Reagan policies. Now, come forward to Trump. He's proposing many of the same things. And by the way, Reagan used tariffs also. Lighthizer was the deputy U.S. trade representative at the time. He's not in the cabinet today, but his protege is. And he's directing a lot of these ideas. In the 80s, Lighthizer took on the Japanese auto industry. Today, Peter Navarro's policies are going to take on the Chinese auto industry and also Canada and Mexico. So you, with tariffs, investment in the U.S., high real wages, again, all real, high real wages, better jobs, you can get that kind of growth. We might have a recession this year. We might be in one already. That's the Biden hangover. But coming out of that, you can see very strong growth in 26, 27, 28. And that's what achieves Bessent's targets. That's what makes it real.
So very well said. We have a real sort of a recent example of how if you play the long game, you will reap the economic rewards, and that's what we're going to have in this country.
So let me just, here's my, I support the tariffs because we have to have our manufacturing base back. Just like I earlier said, you cannot hate the legacy media enough. There's a long list of institutions you cannot hate enough, but the people that you hear, oh my gosh, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, the media, all these people that live in the big cities, what they've been doing is they've been profiting off these huge $2 trillion yearly deficits. And that's not sustainable. If you live in a small or medium town, if you live in Robbins, or you live down in Laurinburg, or you live in Wagram, or you live in any of these towns that were devastated when NAFTA and CAFTA passed and all the industry left, and look what we're left with. You should support the tariffs, because with the tariffs, manufacturing is going to come back to the United States. It was the unfair trade that the Republicans, the Rhino establishment Republicans, teamed with Bill Clinton. Remember? Actually, you know, people forget this. I like, Newt Gingrich, but don't forget that Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House when they partnered with Clinton and passed NAFTA. So, look, you had the Rhino establishment Republicans teaming with the Democrats to scheme against the average working American. Donald Trump is the president of the working American. Donald Trump wants industry to come back to the United States, because without manufacturing, he laid this out in his executive order, without manufacturing, we have no defense. Without manufacturing, we're not creating wealth. Without manufacturing, we don't have jobs for blue call, you know, people coming out of high school to get, you know, good paying jobs like we used to have in Robbins, Laurinburg, Wagram, and all these towns. President Trump and his tariffs are policies for the people. And these people and these institutions that have profited from $31 trillion of government deficit spending just at the federal level, then you get to the deficit spending at the states. Those are the people who are bitching about this.
Yeah, the joke going around is that only Trump could turn the left against electric vehicles, but only Trump could also turn union bosses to his side, to supporting his economic plan, because it affects, they know how it affects their union members. And I'm no union apologist, believe me. You know, we take aim at a lot of nefarious actors and Democrats, but I repeat myself. But sometimes we need to take aim on the stories that the mainstream media is deliberately missing, ignoring is the other word I guess we would use. But here's a big one from last week. This is reported by Todd Benzman, who's one of the leading independent journalist who's covered the border crisis for the past several years. And he reports as follows. It's early, but not too early, to note that President Trump's all-out war on cross-border fentanyl smuggling into the United States, which has been responsible for 120,000 American overdose deaths in recent years. Let that sink in. 120,000 overdose deaths from fentanyl coming in. The efforts to stop that is achieving remarkable impact for the first time in a decade. A key indicator of broader total smuggling at and between the southern borders, which is U.S. law enforcement seizures of fentanyl, has dropped 50% since November. Just since November, the amount of fentanyl that is being seized coming across that border is cut in half. Now, that is a staggering accomplishment.
Well, I mean, look. Illegal aliens attempting to cross the border have dropped 99%. We didn't need new laws. We didn't need new legislation. We just needed a president who cared enough about the health, safety, and welfare and sovereignty of our citizens to actually protect our border and stop this stuff. We're the United States of America. Of course we could have stopped this stuff, just like we could have stopped 9-month-old babies from getting small business loans. It's not a technological impediment that prevents us. It's politicians and bureaucrats who don't care.
And this was a combination of two things. This was sending our troops and our National Guard and everybody else we could round up to the border to shut it down once and for all. And it was also Trump telling Mexico, you know, you've got to get control of these cartels or we're going to tariff you into the ground. And what happens from October of last year through January of this year, Southwest border seizures of fentanyl fell from 2,000 pounds in 85 events to 990 pounds in 47 events.
Yeah, so So let's talk about the first 72 days that good old Spartacus referred to earlier. 72 days, we went from a president and administration who was letting people across the border to rape and murder your neighbor and letting drugs and fentanyl across the border to kill your neighbor to a president who's deporting those rapists and murderers and keeping that fentanyl from coming in. And now the Democrats are suing to keep the rapists and murderers
here. They want them brought back.
Right. Yeah. And they're probably next going to sue to, wait, you stop the fentanyl. We demand somewhere there's a Hawaiian district circuit judge who's going to order the Trump administration to, like, keep the fentanyl coming in. I mean, it's just a matter. The Democrats are completely defending indefensible positions, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, and they looked totally stupid when they tried to cherry pick one of these guys who was sent one of these Venezuelan gang members who was sent to the El Salvadorian prison along with hundreds of others. They tried to cherry pick one guy by saying, well, he had not actually committed any criminal offenses. Well, he's a gang member and he came into our country illegally. What else do you need to know?
That's all I need to
know.
Go commit a crime now, and then we'll do something with you, maybe, as long as you don't, like, rape that person in a sanctuary city who doesn't hold him on an ICE detainer.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess that's what they want.
Right.
See, that's exactly why you can't hate the media enough.
That's exactly. Speaking of media outlets that we loathe, let us turn our attention to The Pilot.
Pravda in the Pines.
Now, you know, I've always thought that it was kind of humorous that a newspaper is called The Pilot because, you know, we expect pilots to safely deliver us when we travel. And this is one pilot that seems to be constantly having trouble navigating, you know, let's say, I don't know, reality.
Certainly the editorial pages have an issue with, say, sanity and reality, yes.
So I often say, and it's true, actually, that I read The Pilot so that you don't have to, you meaning all of our loyal listeners out there. And a lot of them do refuse to read The Pilot because they wish not to enter into a state of mental health crisis. But I have to say that I was above and beyond the call of duty in this past week when I forced myself to read had to have been an 800, 1,000 word guest column penned by one John Dempsey. Now, why does that name sound familiar? Well, John Dempsey was the president of Sandhills Community College for well over three decades, all the way up until about 2023 when he retired. And rode off into the sunset, probably in an electric vehicle, if I had to guess. But he has written a column in The Pilot, which gleefully published it, and the headline reads, and I'm not making this up, "Principles Behind Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Embody Who We Are as a Country." Now, he's a little late to the game here because he may not have noticed that DEI, as it's called, has been exposed for what it actually is, which is unconstitutional race-based policies which value ethnicity and race and other variables over things like, I don't know, qualification and competence, for example. As corporations and the military and many other entities have dropped DEI like a rock, now we have a full-throated defense of it in The Pilot by the former president of a local educational institution.
You know, he could not be more wrong. We will discuss this, I suspect, point by point. But DEI does not embody who we are as a country. A meritocracy, a colorblind meritocracy based upon our Constitution is what defines us as a country. And racism based upon a skin color, however you justify it, does not define us as a country. And I will tell you this, if I was, and you guys will understand why, if I was a logic and rhetoric professor, at Sand Hills Community College, and Mr. Dempsey submitted this paper to me as a submission for a logic and rhetoric. I would give him an F minus.
An F minus?
Yes.
Wow, that's about as low as you can go.
Well, maybe an F minus minus.
Okay.
Just when you thought you couldn't get any lower.
Well, there are some real little gems in here.
Well, let's just start off with, you know, the owner and editor of the Pilot say, well, Mr. David, you're bombastic because you use this inflammatory words. So let's not even, you don't even get through the first sentence of Mr. Dempsey, former president of Sand Hills Community College. The first few months of the Trump-Musk presidency. Right. So right off the bat, he's using extreme left-wing verbology and he's being bombastic. Right.
Yes.
That's not, I thought that the former president of Sand Hills Community College was this centrist, scholarly guy. Well, he's just proven himself in the first sentence to be this hardcore lefty because he's using their verbiage.
I could have disavowed you of that notion. Immediately,
just pointing it out. First sentence,
you're right.
Can't get past the the bombastic left wing rhetoric.
But he says, he goes through. He actually opens the
column. Wait, well, hold on. Here's another example of his bombastic. Trump's biggest fans have a tough time listening to their hero. That's the leftist calling their hero, trying to sell gold-plated Bibles and sneakers and radio commercials. More bombastic. Leftist language.
Yeah, I guess he can't stomach a president having anything to do with the sale of the Holy Bible somehow. That's too much.
So
that's a bridge too far.
Then he goes on to say, the arrogant assertion that the centuries-old homogeny of the white American male is somehow divinely ordained and the result of a colorblind meritocracy. Okay, so first of all, he is using the homogeny of the white American male is a result of a colorblind meritocracy. Yes, it is.
Yeah,
yes,
it is.
America is a meritocracy and has been. That's the great experiment. Like I said, logic F minus minus.
Yeah.
Then he goes on to say in the next paragraph, talking about Trump and his Sharpies, because he's such a mature man that he wouldn't be dignified to stoop down to using Hensley-esque bombastic comments, right? By the way, I want to see Nagy write an editorial rebuttal of this, taking Mr. Dempsey for being, using this sort of language. Anyway, so Trump is attempting to erase 100 years of social progress. Progress earned an inch at a time by Rosa Parks, Ernest Green, Medgar Evers, Cesar Chavez, the kids at the Greenboro lunch counter, one of who's a friend of mine, and the combatants of the Stonewall riots. And he's doing it by attacking some pretty hollowed American beliefs. So first of all those people he talked about, or most of them, were disciples of Martin Luther King, Dr. King, who talked about judging people by the content of their character and their skills and their, not the color of their skin, right? So Dempsey took all these people who believe in judging people by the who convinced America to stop judging people by the color of their skin and let's turn America into a meritocracy for all people.
Yeah.
Dempsey is turning their message on their head, and then he continues by saying some pretty hollowed beliefs. So Dempsey is making the case, if you read the whole thing, he's making the case that judging people by the color of their skin, affirmative action, which he goes on and says that's what it is and that's what he wants to do. He is saying that judging people by the color of their skin is a hollowed American belief because that's what Trump is eliminating.
And he's trying to insinuate not very well that diversity, equity, inclusion is somehow anti-immigrant. He writes, how dull would the American story be if it didn't include chapters on the Irish, the Germans, the Polish, the Mexicans, the Africans,
right,
and the Vietnamese? It would not only be dull, it would be short. Well, DEI, as it's been abused,
has nothing to do with immigration.
Has nothing to do with ethnicity. In that regard,
he's intentionally is setting up a false argument and a false and a whatever. He is trying to trying to say that people who oppose DEI oppose ethnicities and immigration, and that's not true. The two are not related. Immigration is not related to DEI. I just want legal immigration. I want legal immigration based upon merit. Yes. Him and his ilk, they want illegal immigration, preferably based upon skin color.
Yeah, and that's how you get people running departments at universities or rising to officer levels in companies who are unqualified, and everybody's fine with it until all of a sudden they look at their bottom line and the company is not generating profit. It's not meeting its goals. And why?
So let's go into Dempsey's money shot, though, right? So here's where Dempsey really believes. Here's where he really puts his card on the table. And here's where you really know that he's a hard lefty, right? So now he's talking about equity. He says equity, this is his definition, right? I thought he would tiptoe around it, but he just came out and just broadcast to everyone. This is Dr. Dempsey, the 30-year president of Sand Hills Community College. If you wonder how that place got as leftist as it was, here's his view of equity. It involves manipulation of access to opportunity in order to assist groups that have historically had impediments to their progress. So he admits that he wants to manipulate the access to opportunity. Then he further states, equity is what we used to call affirmative action. The Supreme Court has ruled affirmative action is unconstitutional.
Right. So, you know, Yes, it always was affirmative action, and that's why it's being eliminated right and left.
But that's what he is saying, because remember, he said these are, and I quote, hallowed American beliefs. So Dr. Dempsey believes that in manipulating access of opportunity in order to assist a group is a hallowed American value. Then he says, the idea behind affirmative action is simple, taking action to provide a benefit to some while not offering it to others. That is, and if you know what there, John, if you do that on the basis of skin color, which you said you wanted to do, then that is racial discrimination and it's unconstitutional. He said it right there. He wants to manipulate access to opportunity and he wants to provide a benefit to some while not offering it to others. And he wants to do that based upon skin color, not merit.
And when you talk to people who have succeeded in life, who are black Americans, such as one of them he alluded to, not by name, Clarence Henderson, one of the Woolworth lunch counter guys from 1960. When you talk to a Clarence Henderson, who went on to be a very successful businessman, you talk to Ben Carson, you talk to Dr. Carol Swain, who came here last summer to speak about her book, The Adversity of Diversity. All of these people will tell you, I didn't want to be elevated by some false pretense. I wanted to just be given the opportunity. Give me the opportunity and let me run with it. And that's what the American promise is. And he seems to be someone who is talks about what a historian he is. He seems to be trampling on the very essence of the American story. Don't get it.
Don't forget that Mr. DEI has hollowed American principles, Dempsey, right? Don't forget that he's also the guy when HB2 was the law of the land, when it was illegal in North Carolina to allow people of opposite gender go into the opposite locker rooms and bathrooms and whatnot. That was the law. Dr. Dempsey, as president of Sand Hills Community College, appeared on the front page of the Pilot in an interview saying that he wasn't going to obey the law, that he didn't care what the law said, I'm paraphrasing, and that he wasn't going to enforce it on Sand Hills Community College campus. That's the same person. That person under the tutelage of George Little, and when he was chair, and the current chair, Larry Cadell. Yeah. Larry Cadell and George Little let this guy do whatever he wanted. He violated state law, and he had these values.
Yes, absolutely.
And I can only assume that he hired people based upon these values.
Absolutely, he did.
And he implemented, while Sandy Stewart was on the board and Larry Cadell was on the board, he hired all these DEI people with nobody on the board stopped him. None of these great conservatives stopped him. They let Dr. Dempsey, who believes that intentionally discriminating against people based upon their color of their skin are hallowed American beliefs, they let him do whatever he wanted. That's why we have to have principled conservatives who are effective reformers on boards.
And I'll just wrap this up by saying that as a current member of the Board of Trustees, I can assure you that the exorcism of DEI and other of these woke pursuits is underway, well underway. You can take that to the bank.
I think I just saw on the TV that President Trump was selling exorcism water, DEI exorcism water, in a little gold plated thing that you can sprinkle it on.
Hey,
yes,
I'm down. Send me a case, please. Okay, let's move on. Another target in our Taking Aim lineup this week, of course, he pops up like every other week, is our so-called Attorney General Jeff Jackson. He seems to believe that the role of the Attorney General is to oppose everything that the President of the United States and his administration is doing in Washington. Meanwhile, you have a state with many of its own issues that he seems to conveniently overlook. This week, he joined other Democrat states' attorneys general in a multi-state lawsuit challenging the federal government's decision to cut more than $11 billion in health care funding nationwide, a move that will impact North Carolina. And it is true that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services did, in fact, cut $11 billion plus. And why did they do that? Much of those funds had been earmarked during the COVID pandemic, for use during the COVID pandemic. Well, why in the world would we allow all those billions of dollars to be sitting in the state departments of health without any accountability attached to them?
It's
unbelievable.
Think about how much money they must have had. They were under a Democrat governor, and they had so much money, they couldn't squander it fast enough. They literally had more money than they could squander in a timely manner. And that's just incredible. But look, this is what we got, right? When Cooper was in office, he spent all his time pandering to D.C., you know, COVID and Mandy, what's her name, and masks. And he did nothing for the people, right? We had Western North Carolina, you know, flooding, and he didn't do anything.
Correct.
Then you get this clown in, and he spends all his time suing Trump. You get Democrats in office, and they stop worrying about stuff they should worry about, such as the DMV. I mean, get the DMV to work. I mean, they're like Scotland County and Hoke counties, DMVs were shut down. You couldn't get a driver's license for 4 months last year. That is mismanagement.
Still a problem.
Because we elect, well, I don't elect them, but when Democrats get elected governor, they spend more time focused on Washington, D.C. than they do on operating our government and we the people and the citizens of North Carolina. And this is just more of the same. We just need a different governor and attorney general. Maybe
boy, do we
a
ever.
Republican.
Boy, do we ever. Maybe it might have to relocate to a different state. I don't know. It may come to that. But Jackson, the Attorney General of North Carolina, claims that as part of these cuts, North Carolina will lose $230 million in health care funding and many jobs. Well, but again, I'm saying to myself, okay, 80 job losses, he claims, and at least $100 million in lost funding is targeted. But again, this is money that doesn't belong to the state just to do with as it pleases.
It's our money.
Yes.
I'm glad the federal government doesn't spend it and we just have a smaller deficit.
But this is the fourth or fifth time since he's become Attorney General, which, by the way, was only January the 1st, that he has joined in one of these multi-state Democrat lawsuits against various Trump executive orders. And again, I don't know why we shouldn't have an Attorney General who is focused on law and order in his home state rather than clearly trying to position himself as a future political candidate, probably
correct,
for governor.
Right, or Senate, or, you know, a cabinet appointee and a Cory Booker administration, you know, because they'll probably try to run Spartacus here soon.
One last thing I wanted to touch on just real quickly, and then we'll move on to what we're looking ahead to in the coming week. It was noted by a wonderful organization, Media Research Center, and its Newsbusters division, that the false hyperventilating about the members of the Trump administration who were communicating with each other using the Signal app, and that they apparently, you know, exposed all kinds of classified information, which was not the case. But the coverage of that, of their discussion about the Signal app and their use of it, received seven times more coverage by the mainstream media than the actual strikes on the Houthi terrorists, which was the subject of their chat.
Right.
So
we
executed these lethal airstrikes on these Houthi terrorists in Yemen who are pirating our waterways. That was an unmitigated success.
Right.
And the media spent seven times more of its breathlessness on the actual Signal app so-called scandal, which was nothing of the kind.
Let's all say it together. We cannot hate the legacy media enough.
Enough. That's right.
It'll become our chant.
You're absolutely right. By the way, so we're looking ahead. We only need to look ahead right now about 1 hour from now at 1 p.m.
Oh, yes.
In the Carthage Town Square, right out in front of the old courthouse. The historic old courthouse. Starting at 1 o'clock, there is a rally, which has been...
An insurrection. Is it a rally or an insurrection?
Well, it may turn into an insurrection. It's being billed as hands-off, and the point is they're gathering to scream and shout, hands-off of all the stuff that the Department of Government Efficiency is cutting, and they falsely announce and scream to the skies that they're coming after Social Security, that Trump and Musk want to privatize Social Security, cut Medicaid and Medicare benefits and other entitlements. This is their narrative, which is entirely false. But these people are gathering at 1 o'clock in Carthage. And if you want to go up, take a short drive and see what the most hysterical and lunatics in our community and adjacent counties, what they look like and sound like, you'll have your opportunity today. And if you own a Tesla, I would especially encourage you to take a spin around the square, a spin or two or three or however many you have time for.
Yeah, and if you ever wanted, like, you know, enjoy a relatively empty and quiet downtown Southern Pines on a Saturday afternoon, you know, they're all going to be in Carthage, so you'll have Southern Pines to yourself.
But the byways and highways leading in and out of Hoke and Scotland counties will be...
They're bringing people in. But anyway, so here's the thing about this. You know, you think about this, right? So here's what's happened. The people who are stealing the money, the fraud, waste, and abusing grifters, right? They actually have mobilized their sheep, right? The leftist sheep and their supporters, to hands off, demonstrate to keep the fraud, waste, and abuse, because they're the ones profiting from it. And this Indivisible group, you know, I've seen some posts on social media that they're paying people $200 each to show up for protests, right? Well, Indivisible, apparently, from what I've seen, is getting funded from USAID.
Yes.
So that's the gig. Yes. That's the gig, man. The federal government, and we have proof of this now, the federal government, they've been doing it under Republicans and Democrats. It was just supercharged under Biden. I mean, my God, they gave what's-her-name in Georgia marriage, a tooth gap woman. They gave her charity $2 billion.
You mean Stacey Abrams?
Stacey Abrams. The people who are trying to remove the High Falls Dam, the America Rivers, they got $1.3 billion from the Biden administration to go and tear down dams against the wishes of locals. You've got our taxpayers funding the radical left to go and protest, hands off the fraud, waste, and abuse. That's funding the protesters. I mean, these people are so brainwashed, clapping seals. It's amazing.
Speaking of clapping seals,
I should get like at least a golf clap on that one.
Yeah, that was excellent. Yes, very well done, David. Hey, your buddy Phil Berger, the president of the North Carolina Senate.
Oh God!
Now he has been fiercely protecting the tourism, travel and tourism. Yes. Industry in North yes. Carolina for many years.
He probably has a cottage on the Outer Banks that he rents. It's probably just his personal cottage.
But at the expense of who? As a school board member, you'll appreciate this. At the expense of the children. For many years, our kids have been forced to go back to school so late into the at the end of the summer that when they get to the Christmas break in December, they haven't taken their final exams yet. They go away for Christmas break and come back, and then they have to take the exam.
Right, right.
Now, intelligent legislators have been calling for years on the legislators in Raleigh to change the rules so that the kids can go back to school earlier and finish their exams, and so that their academic calendar aligns with that of the community colleges. Berger now is pretending that he's riding in on a white horse to save the situation, with a compromise bill that he says will assuage the concerns of the travel and tourism folks, and also addresses what I understand is the excuse that we hear from schools, that they want to align with community college and that they want to do final exams before Christmas break. Well, that's not an excuse. That's a reality.
Right. No.
That's a real thing. So he also, as part of this bill, wants to impose on school districts stricter penalties for those who have said, you know what, we're going to use the calendar that best suits the needs of our children. We are done with this ridiculous law. And many of them have willfully broken the law. And there have been very little in the way of lawsuits or legal action taken against them. But this bill is now out there to move everything back by 1 week. So maybe it's a step in the right direction.
So, well, let's talk about the Phil Berger, right? So no conservative. There are three repugnant things about this, right? First of all, is the first repugnant thing is that anyone would interfere with the education of our children and the local control of the school calendar to benefit political donors, right? That's literally what he's doing. He gets money from lobbyists, so he's literally harming the education of every public school child in the entire state. That's unacceptable. Then when you get down to it, this bill that he's introduced, it does two horrendous things. One is, and it shows what a coward Phil Berger is, because what it does is it gives the administrative, the state, the power to punish school districts. That bill gives the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction the sole right to investigate school districts that may be disobeying the calendar. And if they are, then North Carolina DPI by law will have to withhold funds from the central office. That is because he's too cowardly to actually go after them. Then finally, it empowers trial lawyers, because that bill further gives parents and other people extended rights to file lawsuits against school district that does this. So this just goes to show what a creep Phil Berger is. There's nothing conservative about this. We need local control of our school calendars. I want special interest out of our school calendars, and I do not want an expansion of the deep state.
This would not be as disturbing, because everything you're talking about sounds like it would be something pushed by Democrats,
right. That Phil Berger is, I mean, he needs to go.
But that's why he's being primaried next year by Sheriff Sam Page.
We all need to pull our checkbooks out.
Rockingham County, yes. Get behind Sheriff Sam Page.
Yes.
And finally put an end to his death grip on the Senate presidency in Raleigh. I think that's the... I think that's the cue, David.
That's it. Another exciting showdown. I think I'm going to go showdown. I get it.
Not only are we not going to take it anymore, we're not going to keep talking anymore because, in fact, our time is up. We want to thank everyone for joining us for another edition of Taking Aim. I'm Steve Woodward. He's David Hensley.
And we're Taking Aim.